Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back a great guest co-host today, Dr. Michael Maka-Atlas. Welcome, Michael, back to Your Health.
Thanks for having me again on the show today, Adam.
Oh, it's great to have you. You know, we've got a really fascinating show. We're going to be talking with Dr. Yun Arn Retinyan, the interim CEO for a newly launched coalition to prepare for epidemics, who is also closely involved with trials of the Ebola vaccine. I'm looking forward to talking with him.
This really sounds wonderful. I mean, he's working on really fighting against epidemics before they break out.
First, though, we've got some really interesting research that matters. And let's just dive right into our very first one about noise exposure and hearing loss. First off, I got to disclose, I do believe I got a little bit of hearing loss, and it probably came from noise exposure.
What'd you say, Adam?
Yes, exactly. And this is the interesting aspect of this, is that we really do know that to a quarter of the population may have hearing loss, and it may have come, in many cases, from loud noises being exposed, including things like concerts, but also things like, you know, turning the music up.
What was really interesting about this was the fact that about over 50% of these people said they had no regular exposure to loud noise at work. So this means that potentially this came from other environmental exposures that we sometimes don't regularly think about.
Yeah, I found some of these things just unbelievable, really. Like, you know, the start of hearing loss is really unrecognized, and that 19% of people between ages of 20 and 29, which you're probably at the tail end of that, had some hearing loss. That alone is concerning.
One thing that I was hoping that they touched on in this, Adam, as well as looking into earbud or headphone use, and during this, they did not look at personal listening devices, but hopefully something that we can look forward to in the future.
Our next research that matters. Do we need to worry about the packaging of fast foods and chemicals? Is that something you've actually even thought about before you read this research?
No, on my way over here, you know, in the burger that I had, I hadn't thought about it. But in fact, you know, this is something that we really need to pay attention to. So beginning in February, the Journal for Environmental Science and Technology Letters put out this paper looking at fluorinated chemicals. And Adam, these are really pretty significant. These have been associated with cancer, thyroid disease, low birth weight, and even decreased fertility. And they found that there were increased levels in almost half of paper wrappers and 20% of paperboard samples. And that includes boxes for, you know, things we usually think about like fries, pizza, burger wrappers. Pretty scary.
Yeah, they tested 400 samples from 27 fast food chains. And they looked for this class of chemicals called PFAs, also known as PFCs. And these are chemicals that are highly fluorinated, which in this case is not a really good idea. And they're found in lots of actually products but in daily life, like carpeting and things that you may not actually be ingesting. And so the question was, how many of them are in these things that we may be ingesting? And the answer is, it may be an issue. Certainly gives me pause for thinking, goodness gracious, we know fresh fruits, vegetables, whole grains, organic, what, you know, the things that you can get farm to table, nothing bad about those things, but a lot of the population doesn't have access or is not doing that. It suggests we perhaps should try to get more research, but maybe give a little caution.
I think this certainly, for those of us who have tried to have a New Year's resolution to indulge in fast food less, I think this all gives us another reason to maybe stay away.
We're going to have to go to our next research that matters, which really is about a statement from the American Heart Association published in their journal called Circulation. And it involves this complex interaction between planning of meals, the timing of eating, and do those things impact your heart health, your cardiovascular health, the circulation health? And for most people, do they even think about these things?
Well, I find a lot of patients who come in to see us find that they're skipping meals. And when they actually looked at this, they found that there was a link between eating breakfast and having lower heart disease risk factors. And specifically, about 20% to 30% of U.S. adults who skip breakfast are more likely to be obese, have inadequate nutrition, and show evidence of impaired glucose metabolism or to be diagnosed with diabetes.
Yeah, it's the diabetes, it's the heart disease, it's the weight gain, it's high blood pressure, blood sugars. These are all things that I think are kind of scary in terms of how they can impact health. And, you know, skipping meals, breakfast, I think as a doctor, you know, you probably skip meals as much as some. And perhaps the advice we give to patients is the advice we should, you know, take for ourselves.
I think we really need to take a look at this closely and pay attention to some of these trends that we're seeing. However, I will say that the evidence from this statement did not definitively show that suggested eating patterns could cause better and lasting benefits. So it's just something to keep in mind that this is something that we're going to continue to probably address with our patients moving forward.
Yeah, I liked one of their statements was, you know, you shouldn't wake up in the middle of the night and have a big meal.
As I call it, fourth meal.
Well, it's interesting because it may actually stimulate inflammation in the body. That's not when the body's used to digesting a meal and the body's resting and also has to gear up, and that can cause an inflammatory response. So I thought, very interesting. Wake up in the middle of the night, maybe a little hungry, maybe a glass of water.
Maybe just a glass.
Let's talk about our last research that matters. Something else, as a young physician, Michael, I think you probably have some thoughts about, which is driving when you're drowsy.
And this isn't what we usually think about when we think about fatal crashes in a word starting with D. We usually think about drunk driving. So this is something a little different. And this was found in the journal Sleep and took crash data from 2010 that showed that there were about 5,500 fatal crashes for a total estimated cost of $110 billion per year in individuals who are found to be involved with drowsy driving. So drowsy driving can mimic alcohol-impaired driving in many ways. It can lead to slower reaction times, impaired attention, and impairment in decision-making processes. Some things that we really align with when we think about, you know, other alcohol-related driving or other things that can impair our driving ability.
Yeah, we used to, in the times before we had work hour limitations for resident physicians, we had a resident, you know, a decade ago who fell asleep on the way home after a 24-hour shift and went off the road and wasn't seriously injured, but could have killed himself, could have killed someone else. And this idea that it's as bad impairment as being drunk really, I think, is the double D, the drowsy or drunk. These are really preventable things. They talk about taking a short nap, getting off the road, having a caffeinated drink in the short term, things that can perhaps prevent a fatal accident.
We as residents, I think, underestimate the risk of driving drowsy. And I think it is important if you're experiencing drowsiness while driving to also talk to your doctor about other medical conditions that could be causing it, such as sleep apnea or potentially a drug side effect. So other things to keep in mind as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. They did say that sometimes people who are driving while drowsy are also frequent visitors to nightclubs and thrill seekers. So I don't know if that applies to our resident physicians, hopefully not, but I do think it suggests to us if you've had an accident and it was because of falling asleep, we should really try to prevent any more further down the road. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Yun Arn Retinyan, the interim CEO for the newly launched Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, about starting the fight against epidemics before they break out. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Bach-Atlas. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Bach-Atlas. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Yun Arn Retinyan, the interim CEO for a newly launched Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, about starting the fight against epidemics before they break out.
Welcome, Dr. Retinyan. We really appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you for having me, and we really appreciate that.
You know, It's not every day that we have a physician from Oslo who also has two masters and a PhD. Tell us a little about you and your path to where you are now.
I trained as a physician here in Norway, and I started doing quite sort of basic biomedical research, cell physiology, cellular signaling during medical school. So I did a combined MD-PhD program. Then I had the opportunity to get on to Oxford as a Norwegian scholar and more or less decided to go for something completely different, global health and in modeling of infectious disease. So that was where I did my master's degree in infectious disease epidemiology and modeling. Then after returning to Norway, I gradually did more health services and health policy related research. And that led me, a combination of those, I guess, led me to Harvard and a visiting professor at the School of Public Health and the deanship of Julio Frenk, where I focused on global health governance and global health policy. And during the period at Harvard, I did a mid-career degree in at the Kennedy School of Government. And in many ways, I spent that year trying to understand how economists think, because I see that economists have a tremendous impact on how we run the world. So quite a mixed background being a physician in training.
And was there one area, one thing that happened either that you saw in the global health arena or that you experienced that was kind of influential, made you say, ha, this is something really important? What was it?
I believe it was my engagement in discussions, negotiations at the World Health Organization on the balance between incentivizing innovation through the patent system, and but at the same time securing access for medicines to populations in need. And in particular, the challenges related then to developing new drugs, diagnostics, and vaccines for so-called neglected diseases or poverty-related diseases. I saw there that really the governments and potentially public benefit-motivated foundation would need to do something, and this was really in the space of economists. So I think that motivated me to learn more about sort of business models and how the economy could be useful to the public benefit.
And we'll get into some more of those challenges and more specifics shortly, but maybe you can just start by telling our listeners briefly what the coalition is. I believe the acronym is CEPI.
Yes, that's right. And I think I can explain my motivation for being involved in CEPI, because my history with the World Health Organization took me really into the midst of the discussions around vaccine development during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. At a high-level meeting in October 2014, there were discussions on how to move forward with speedy efficacy trials of vaccines in the three Ebola-stricken countries. There were no planned trials for Guinea. There were clearly strong and large trials planned for Liberia and Sierra Leone. And we convened a small group, and later, a couple of weeks later, I chaired a working group planning vaccine trials in Guinea. And then during the next 9 months, we initiated, we planned, we secured financing, and we implemented and actually published the results of large efficacy trials, cluster randomized trial, the so-called ring vaccination trial in Guinea. And I think the issue of why we were late in actually delivering vaccines in the Ebola outbreak, because we had that very promising vaccine that had full efficacy in animal models back in 2005, but none of them were taken forward in clinical trials. That demonstrated the deficiency of the system. And then I think the combination of vaccine trials conducted in these three countries really also demonstrated that there is an opportunity here. And this Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation, or CEPI, I think was kind of established based on both the big problem of lack of investments in vaccine development for epidemic disease, but also the opportunity. So if we can do these investments ahead of outbreaks, we would be able to stop outbreaks at an earlier stage. And in the case of the Ebola outbreak, we would probably should have started use and efficacy trials of vaccine almost 6 to 9 months, I guess, earlier. So that's the core idea of CEPI, to develop vaccine through phase one and phase two trials ahead of outbreaks and do that for targeted diseases. But in addition, also establish capacities to do fast-track vaccine development if there is a new unknown emergent virus disease that is kind of the main pathogen.
You have what is called a pragmatic design, which allowed, I guess, the team in Guinea to assess the vaccine in the middle of an epidemic. That seems remarkable. Tell us how that sort of trial, this pragmatic trial, differs from perhaps a different trial that many of us are familiar with, the randomized controlled trial that frequently takes years to develop and years to implement.
Yes. No, these decisions were made, of course, in the context of the outbreak and really the context of increasing number of cases every week in the fall of 2014. The challenge was that we really had very little capacity on the ground in Guinea for doing clinical trials. The standard way, the gold trial sort of with large individual randomization would more or less mean that we would need to vaccinate tens of thousands, maybe up to 100,000 individuals to make sure that we had sufficient number of enrolled patients. And that would really not be feasible in Guinea at that time and due to lack of capacity. So our idea was to learn from what had been done during the smallpox eradication, where new cases were identified and then contacts and the community around cases were vaccinated to avoid further spread of smallpox. So this sort of ring vaccination strategy was, of course, used as the public health response. And our thinking in the context of Ebola was that we should do a pragmatic trial, which would be very similar to how we would foresee that vaccines would be used in the future to actually stop outbreaks. But the ring vaccine had never been used as a trial and a research design. So we needed to think about how could we do this in a controlled manner so that we could actually have sufficient robustness when it comes to valid data and evidence generation. So that's why we did this ring vaccination in a clustered randomized trial approach where we vaccinated all individuals in the rings or these contacts of new cases immediately, or we delayed that vaccination in the control group for 3 weeks.
Remarkable.
So that's managed to actually create and sufficient robust data to demonstrate the efficacy of the vaccine.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, we're going to continue this conversation about vaccine preparedness, who's involved, how are they doing it, how well is it working. We're going to be talking again after the break with Dr. Yun Arne Rotenyan, the interim CEO for the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness, about the fight against epidemics before they break out. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Bach-Atlas. We've been talking with Dr. Yun Arne Rotenyan, the interim CEO for the newly launched Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, about starting the fight against epidemics before they break out. Before the break, we were discussing the trials using new vaccinations, and we'd really like to hear the outcomes of those trials, Dr. Rotenyan.
It was a remarkable situation when we opened the trial results, and it was actually during my visit to Guinea in late June 2015, because what we did see was that after the 10 days that we decided not to count cases, and I will get back to why not. There were no cases in the rings or the clusters or the groups that had received immediate vaccination, and in total, there were 23 cases in the other clusters. So more or less demonstrating 100% efficacy, of course, with the limited numbers we had. The reason why we couldn't really count new cases in the 10 first days is that, of course, we knew that among the contacts of new Ebola cases, some of them would already be incubating the disease and would already be infected. So we would expect that both in the early vaccination group and in the late vaccination group, there were people that were already infected than when vaccinated. So after these 10 days, there were really a flat signal, no new cases in the vaccinated group, and 23 cases divided by 11 in 11 clusters in the other group. So very promising results.
It is quite amazing, not only that you were able to do it, but you showed an outcome that could prevent new cases in the middle of a vaccination. And I wonder if you now believe that this is potentially a model for studying other diseases. And you're studying some diseases that most of the population know among my colleagues. We may not have even heard of these diseases. Tell us about the diseases. I know you're studying Lassa and Nipah, MERS. What are you studying and how are you going about it?
Yeah, so we have decided to prioritize these three diseases. I should first say, though, that we will make sure that we finish the job on Ebola vaccines. And in this large partnership, we are discussing now with regulatory agencies and with the companies and other actors what sort of data would be needed so that we make sure that we have one Ebola vaccine or several Ebola vaccines that are approved and can be ready to be used in the next outbreak situation. But then in addition, we selected these three diseases from a larger list of priorities that the World Health Organization has set. And I would like to emphasize that the World Health Organization, who was the leading implementing agency also in the Guinea ring vaccination trial, it's key that we start with the guidance and the priorities set by that organization, being in a way the only global international organization with a legitimate mandate to do so. The three diseases are different. We have MERS, which is first and foremost in the Middle East, and it's believed to transmit from camels, not easily, but can transmit to humans. And then we in particular see outbreak situations when they further transmit in hospital settings. So the idea would be to vaccinate to limit the first transmission from camels to those who work with camels. Then Nipah is a virus that first and foremost transmitted either directly from fruit bats or via pigs, farming pigs, to the population. That's a quite rare disease, but it has a very high lethality if first infected. And we've seen outbreaks in Malaysia and Bangladesh, and we are afraid it will spread to other countries in that region. And then Lassa fever is a bit different. It's transmitted from rodents, and most of those being infected are actually asymptomatic or they have very mild flu-like symptoms. But then a subgroup tend to have a much more serious disease and with a very high lethality. So the idea of having a vaccine for this disease is, of course, to make sure that we can protect those with the serious disease pathway, which also include pregnant women. The way we would use vaccines on these three diseases would be different.
This is quite a large-scale effort that you're working on these vaccines for these several diseases and other diseases that you've been working on before. I understand that you've partnered with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Wellcome Trust. What other organizations or governments are helping to coordinate this large-scale effort?
Yes, we have kind of estimated that we need $1 billion to actually bring vaccines forward for these three diseases, as well as finishing Ebola. And of course, that's a large investment. So we need a consortium of investors to collaborate. And the two foundations you mentioned, Gates Foundation, Wellcome Trust, is among them, but also the governments of Japan, Germany, and Norway. In addition, we are currently discussing with additional governments in both the so-called G7 and G20 groups. And we expect and hope that more governments will join in. In many ways, we see this as a global health insurance mechanism for countries to contribute to development of technologies that can reduce risk for everyone.
As I think about vaccine development, I know in the United States, one of the problems is that there's this group of peoples and organizations who feel perhaps oppositely that we should be vaccinating less, not more. And yet some of the most common diseases that resurged are vaccine preventable. I think about measles around the world. How can the work that you're doing, does it have any influence or role? And what do you say to those who really are saying we need maybe to do less vaccines versus more to preserve public health?
Well, I think an initiative like ours really need to situate ourselves into the wider discussions on vaccination and vaccine. And vaccine hesitancy is an increasing problem, maybe first and foremost in richer countries in Europe and in North America. And I think the main reason for that sort of movement is that due to our rather high vaccine coverage, we never see these diseases anymore, the childhood infections that in the old days led to serious disease and deaths among young children. And by not having that memory again in the population, of course, the population then starts to focus more on the potential risks. And unfortunately, there are misbeliefs and misunderstanding of data and evidence in this space. I think actually demonstrating how these both the childhood vaccines today have large impact on child health in developing countries, and also demonstrate how, like for instance, the Ebola vaccine can really contribute to stopping outbreaks that led to a catastrophe in the three West African countries. I think that could also help the common understanding that vaccines has an important role to play to prevent infectious disease. I think there is a potential bidirectional kind of link between our efforts and the more general childhood vaccination discussion.
We have just a short amount of time left. If you could leave our listeners with a final thought regarding your work and even on a larger scale, what would that be?
I believe that no country can do this effort alone. We really need to collaborate. And that means that we need to develop vaccines, but also diagnostics and therapeutics for diseases where we really do not know where they will hit, when they will hit, and what pathogen it will be. It's really the strongest case for international collaboration. And I think we have a scientific community, we have companies that are ready to deliver. And what we need is a collective coordination and financing mechanisms where countries can contribute. And I hope that CEPI is the start of that and that we will get more investors in the years to come.
The work you're doing is amazing. It's exciting. We are thrilled to see the types of outcomes that you're doing, and we know it's saving lives on a global scale. Your career is one that we admire and we want to hopefully promote to Your Health listeners around the world.
Thanks for having me, Michael and Adam. And I must say they have been really rewarding for me to be a part of this effort, and I appreciate to have the opportunity to tell you and your listeners a bit about CEPI.
We've been talking with Dr. Yun Arne-Rutinen, the interim CEO for an amazing new coalition for epidemic preparedness innovation to fight against epidemics before they break out. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Bacchialis. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Michael and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth1word@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question.
So our first question today comes from someone whose wife is expecting their first child this year. And he asks, we have an indoor cat, and I've heard it's bad for pregnant women to be in charge of litter box duty. Why is that?
Well, this is a really good question, and there's elements here that perhaps people are worried about that may not be the biggest thing they should be worried about, and some things that maybe they're not worried about that we're going to maybe talk about. What do you think, Michael?
So in regards to this and the sort of litter box and cats and pregnancy, what does this all mean? So the biggest concern where this comes from is an infection with something called toxoplasmosis, and this can be transmitted from a pregnant woman to the fetus and can cause a number of complications. It's actually been shown that cats are weak, have a weak association with actually causing an infection, and that fresh cat feces are not truly infectious, but it is recommended in terms of measures of different prevention to prevent this particular infection, that there should be a little bit of off-duty on litter box, and this responsibility may be able to be passed on to someone else in the household or a friend.
Yeah, and one of the things that people probably don't think about is what are the kind of larger risk factors for maternal exposure and perhaps passing on toxoplasmosis. One of them is traveling to an area where this is more endemic, where you find this organism, some less developed countries, particularly in South America, drinking unfiltered water, so water that's contaminated, that can happen in places. If you're an area where the soil could be more contaminated and the vegetables are coming off, certainly washing the hands and washing the vegetables, and then eating uncooked or raw, undercooked meat can certainly be. So these are things that perhaps people don't think about. They're basic, I think, hygiene things that would be helpful. Those would be things that you can perhaps prevent.
Hand washing is key, I think, first and foremost throughout all pregnancy. Like you said, with cooking, washing vegetables, regular, frequent hand washing, I don't think you can go wrong.
Yeah, and you always have the husband change litter box. That's
yeah.
a good thing.
It
doesn't ever hurt.
Yeah, never hurts.
Or what's our very next house call?
After having my blood drawn, my doctor called and said he wanted to retest me because my potassium was too high. It came back normal the second time, but it made me wonder, what are the causes and the risks of high potassium?
They want us to give away all the secrets of
all
doctoring, you know, and just this one question here. Well, that's a really good question. We'll give you a few of our secrets, but if you want to find more, you got to come talk with us. what's one of the first things that comes to mind, Michael? Because this is a common issue, whether it's the potassium comes back high, the sodium comes back low, the blood count comes back just on the upper side of normal.
We always think about laboratory errors, and there certainly are a possibility. But when it comes to high potassium, I think many patients think that usually that they're eating or taking in too much potassium, when in fact, the majority of the causes of elevated potassium are actually due to the body's ability or inability to not excrete potassium.
Yeah, and that can actually happen in a lot of different ways, many of which are actually not serious illnesses. Exercise can sometimes cause release of potassium from cells. There's some common medications that people take that can cause alterations of potassium or buildup in potassium. Those could actually be harmful. So you really need to, I think, look at it and try to find out what the cause is. I wouldn't just accept. Would you just accept that a potassium of upper limit that's normally 5, and if you have a potassium of 5.8? Would that concern you as a doctor?
Yeah, I think that you have to take the patient into consideration is most important. So where I get a little bit more worried are individuals who have already known chronic kidney disease or may even be on dialysis. It's important that their potassium is monitored. I think things to look out for are if someone's having muscle weakness or increased paralysis, or they're maybe feeling heart palpitations, would be a good reason to get checked out sooner rather than later.
Yeah, we oftentimes see and worry about low potassium, hypokalemia, but this elevated potassium, the hyperkalemia, can be very toxic to the heart, and that's what we really get concerned about. It can cause arrhythmias and the heart to really not function appropriately, and that can be life-threatening. So if the potassium's off, try to find out the reason, repeat it, all seems reasonable. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm in my 40s, and I want to get LASIK surgery. What do you tell your patients who are considering this procedure?
When I have patients come in who talk about LASIK surgery, I think it's the right patient at the right time in their lives. You know, you find people who just aren't doing well with their glasses or even their contact lenses, and they're looking for something that's just maybe a little bit easier. And I think one of the more important things is for them to get a, you know, a accurate evaluation done by an ophthalmologist. And really one of the things that we can do is to go over some of the, you know, simpler questions that patients may have, like, you know, what time of their life might be a good option for them to get this done? What are some of the complications after the procedure is done? And how often are people really satisfied with this procedure?
Yeah, it really having that right patient, I think, is really important here, who is not outside the age range that the data has been shown, who has the right curvature that can respond to this, that perhaps has no other medical problems with their eyes that might predispose them to really dry eyes. They don't have glaucoma. They don't have cataracts. They don't have some sort of vascular disease that could, you know, these are things that may be obvious to the doctors, maybe not be obvious. And, you know, so I think both asking the doctor, is it safe for me? And then also understand that LASIK is just one type of refractive eye surgery. There are other types and things, and I don't know, Michael, if we can actually pronounce them, but one of them is Sub-Bowman keratomyelosis photorefractive keratectomy laser epithelial keratomyelosis. We'll call it LASIK.
You lost me at sub. That was about it. The most important thing is patients can get an evaluation, and ultimately then they can decide if this is a good fit for them still. But I would send my patients to be evaluated.
Yeah, the satisfaction is pretty high for those who've had it, but there are the risk and knowing what those risks are and being willing to accept them. Laura, what's our last house call?
My father's been experiencing mild to moderate discomfort in his lower abdomen for a few weeks now. His doctor assured us that it's nothing, but I'm not so sure that I agree. First, what else should we watch out for? And second, how do you navigate the situation when you disagree with your doctor?
Well, the doctor's always right, so.
Always.
Except
it's
us.
Never comes up.
Except us. But this is such a great question. And I had a patient just the other day, Michael, who came in with this discomfort in the lower abdomen. And, you know, the doctor is examining and also forming what they think's going on. And then they really have to also say, what do you think's going on? In this particular case, my patient was concerned about cancer. And, you know, then that precipitates a conversation. I happen to think that there was lots of extra stool in the abdomen, and the patient said they had been constipated. But, you know, that could be true, unrelated, you know. And so deciding, do you do more testing? Do you do blood work? Do you do an X-ray? What are your thoughts, Michael?
So this really question gets at to why, you know, I love family medicine so much, and continuity, building trust between a primary care doctor and the patient, and being able to have these sometimes difficult, you know, conversations where maybe somebody disagrees with the management or what's been going on. And when I hear other family members say, you know, I am really concerned about a patient, it really kind of makes me take a step back and ask myself, am I missing something? Do I need to go back and, you know, explore other alternatives, other diagnoses? And really that, you know, that conversation is something that I welcome to all my patients.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And also, I like to always say, and what do you think? You know, does the plan that I just proposed sound reasonable? And hopefully that's an opportunity to say, no, I really would like an X-ray. And then we can talk about it, because there may be risk of an X-ray, but there may be, well, I don't feel so strongly that that's the worst thing in the world either. And we can agree to either disagree, or we may come to agreement.
I think the word we're looking for is the shared decision-making.
Excellent. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all our listeners for joining us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can send your own questions, your own stories, yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search our health app, Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Yun Arne Rutenyen. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.